Thanks. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. It's very nice to be in a city with trams. Or are they trolleys here? Trams? Trams, okay. So, also I, you know, appreciate you coming to a lecture on three manifolds. I know it's not really the topic of the conference, but maybe it'll also have something to do with partially hyperbolic dynamics, though maybe that sort of it is a little bit more conjectural. So the idea is that this is a context in which maybe partially hyperbolic dynamics are going to emerge not sort of by fiat or because of some local geometry like negative curvature or something like that, although, but in fact from some sort of global consideration, again, like negative curvature, but a global negative curvature rather than a local. So I have a, my convention is all manifolds are going to be orientable, but most of what I'm going to say is going to, would apply equally well to non-orientable manifolds or flows which are, or one-dimensional foliations rather than flows. So I'm interested in flows on three manifolds, and for me, flows, I guess, are going to be leafwise C1. Transversely, I don't really care C0. Even leafwise C1 is not really necessary. And so, but the control that one gets is going to come from more global geometric considerations. So I want to start by talking about product-covered flows. So for me, I'm going to think of a one-dimensional flow. On a three-manifold, I'm going to denote the flow by X. I'll stop writing threes on my manifolds. And I'm also going to confuse the flow with the foliation by flow lines. So for me, they're going to be basically the same thing. And so a product-covered flow, well, in general, but in this context, is going to be a flow on a three-manifold such that, now, I'm going to work in the universal cover a lot, and any object on a manifold, when it gets pulled back to the universal cover, gets a twiddle on it. So we have a pulled back flow or foliation on the universal cover, which also gets a twiddle. This is basically going to have flow lines which are the vertical lines in R3. I mean, in particular, M twiddle is R3, which is already sort of saying something about the three manifold. And then the leaf space then is topologically a plane. So we have the space of leaves. I'm going to denote P sub X is going to be homeomorphic to a plane. So this is my definition of a product-covered flow. So this is the topological definition. Now I'm going to make a geometric definition, which is, again, with reference really to properties in the universal cover. So here we want flow lines of X twiddle to be, well, properly embedded in M twiddle, but even uniformly properly embedded. So what do I mean by that? I mean that there's some uniform way of comparing distance in a flow line with distance in the universal cover. So I apologize in advance for my handwriting. Distance in a flow line and in M2. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. I can't hear you.
What are cycles
Horacycle flow would not do. Wait, horacycle flow, why would it not do?
What?
Why would it not do? Well, but that's okay. I only say that there is a uniform comparison, but that the comparison function, all it has to do is be unbounded. So log is okay. Yeah, in fact, all I mean is that there's some function which says, yeah, which, the properness of it. So there's proper means, pick some point in the flow line. As I get further away in the flow line, I get further away in M twiddle. I don't say how fast, but there's some rate at which I get further away. Uniform means I don't have to fix a base point. So there's a function f such that and, so I guess from R plus to R plus, proper monotone, blah, 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 such that if distance in a flow line between P and Q is, let's see, f of this is, so we have distance in M twiddle between P and Q, and this should be at least as big as f of the distance in L between P and Q. So all I mean is, if points are really far apart in a flow line, they're really far apart in M twiddle, but the comparison function could get worse and worse and worse. It could be log or log of log of log or any number of them, but just some fixed function. And I guess I should maybe stress that I'm only interested in closed three manifolds, so compact three manifolds, no boundary. All right. Well, so the key point of uniformity of flow lines is that the leaf space is going to be Hausdorff. And the reason for that is, well, how do leaf spaces fail to be Hausdorff? You have a one-parameter family of leaves, which may be limits to more than one leaf. So you have points, pairs of points on leaves whose distance is staying bounded in the space but is getting bigger and bigger in the ambient leaf. So uniform flows, pictures like this don't arise, so the leaf space is Hausdorff. And if you're on the universal cover, the leaf space is going to be simply connected. So on a three-manifold, the leaf space is going to be, well, a sphere or a plane. So unless M is, you know, a circle bundle over a sphere, these two concepts are equivalent. So for cases of interest, these are the same. All right, so now I'm interested in quasi-geodesic flows, so let me tell you what a quasi-geodesic is first, and I'm always interested in hyperbolic manifolds, so I'll only tell you what a quasi-geodesic is in H3. Well, so quasi-geodesic, if you like, is a map from R to hyperbolic space. Excuse me. For which there exists some number k such that, well, let me see exactly how I want to put this. Well, one has a sort of a Bi-Lipschitz comparison with bounded additive error. So and maybe annoyingly to some people, I tend to use the same constant for my multiplicative, my additive constant, because I don't really care what the constant is. So, well, if you just parameterize these, this guy by arc length, then, well, I mean, the second inequality is satisfied because, I mean, you're at least as far away in the flow line as you are in H3. But the really interesting inequality is the first one, which, ignoring this sort of additive term, says for big enough segments, well, not only is there a uniform comparison, but it's multiplicative. So the Horace cycle flow does not do in this case. Yes, all right. So notice I'm just saying there exists a K. So I talk about a quasi-geodesic flow. Is one for which all flow lines of X twiddle are quasi-geodesic. And so, I mean, if I choose two different parameterizations of my flow, if I change time on the manifold M, well, M is compact, so that only changes the flow rates by a bounded multiplicative constant, so the property of being quasi-geodesic is preserved. Similarly, if I change my metric on M, and I don't need a Riemannian metric, any path metric will do, the property of quasi-geodesity is still preserved. Okay. So this is really a topological property of the flow on the manifold. It's not a metric property. So the key point to observe or recall or recognize is that quasi-geodesity is a local property in hyperbolic spaces. I.e., if you're not 2K quasi-geodesic, say, look, if you're not K quasi-geodesic, you only need to look at segments of some bounded length to discover this fact. So failure to be K quasi-geodesic for any K can be certified by looking at segments of length less than or equal to some constant, which depends on K. I'm always working in hyperbolic space. If one had other more general delta hyperbolic spaces, the constant would depend on delta, but I don't care about that. And this has the following corollary. It says that if we have a quasi-geodesic flow on a compact manifold, then K can be chosen independently of the flow line. There exists a uniform K which works for all flow lines. Well, so why should this be true? Well, one gets a foliation in the universal cover by flow lines, and leaves converge on compact subsets. So if some leaf fails to be, say, 2 to the I quasi-geodesic, there's a segment of length C 2 to the I, which is not 2 to the I quasi-geodesic, and that contains a subsegment of length C 2 to the I minus 1, which is not 2 to the I minus 1 quasi-geodesic, sorry, 2 to the I plus 1 quasi-geodesic, and so on and so forth. And one gets a nested sequence of segments of bounded length. By diagonalizing, one gets a limit leaf, which is not quasi-geodesic for any K. So let me just sort of repeat that with some pictures. So if some flow line Li is not through the eye, quasi-geodesic. So here is the flow line. So it has some long segment of length C to the eye, which is not to the eye quasi-geodesic, and that contains some sub-segment of length C to the eye minus 1, which is not to the eye minus 1 quasi-geodesic. I mean, if you're not to the eye quasi-geodesic, you're certainly not to the eye minus 1 quasi-geodesic, and so on and so forth. We get this nested sequence of segments of uniformly bounded length. Pick some point in the middle, take a sequence of these LIs, transport them around by elements of your fundamental group so that these base points, PI, converge to some limit point P. Then these boxes are all of bounded length. So the blue box limits to some blue box, the green box limits to a green box, the red box limits to a red box, the orange one. Anyway, you get the idea. So the limiting leaf is not to the eye quasi-geodesic for any eye, so it's not quasi-geodesic. So this is an argument by contradiction to say that if you're quasi-geodesic on a hyperbolic manifold, if every flow line is individually quasi-geodesic, well, there's a uniform constant which works for all flow lines. So in particular, quasi-geodesic flow is a uniform flow, and therefore it's a product-covered flow. All right, well, so that's just sort of set up. So I have a hyperbolic 3-manifold H3 mod some discrete free co-compact lattice, and it has a flow X, which is quasi-geodesic. So it's product covered. We have a leaf space P sub X of X twiddle, which is homeomorphic to a plane. Pi 1 acts on this leaf space, so we get a representation called the holonomy representation from pi 1 of M to the group of homeomorphisms of the plane. Let me put a little plus there because everything's orientable in my world. Okay. So what I want to sort of impress on you today is that in many ways this flow shares some global features in common with pseudo-Anosov flows. By the way, what examples are there of such gadgets? Pseudo-Anosov flows. Yeah, so I mean a suspension flow of a pseudo-Anosov map would be an example of a pseudo-Anosov flow. Yeah. So that would also be an example of a quasi-geodesic flow. So well, let's say if M fibers over the circle and we have some closed one form which vanishes on the fibers of the fibration pulled back from the angle form on S1, well, any vector field which pairs positively with this one form at every point has to make definite progress in the universal cover, so it's quasi-geodesic. So M has non-degenerate closed one-form alpha. Any X on M with alpha X, I guess I just need to say non-zero, is quasi-geodesic. And I think this example is due to Zorich. It's certainly in a paper of his. Maybe a lot of other people know it too. A kind of slightly more wriggly version of this, if M slithers over S1, by which I mean the universal cover fibers over S1 in such a way that pi 1 acts by bundle maps, a similar kind of construction works. So X exists. The reason to write this down is that this is kind of a coarse version of fibering over a circle, but it has the nice feature that, well, one can find some examples where M is a rational homology sphere. I mean, if you fiber over a circle, you're not a rational homology sphere. These are some examples where you might be a rational homology sphere, but still there's some kind of robust construction of quasi-geodesic flows. An example of M slithering over a circle is M could be a unit tangent bundle of a hyperbolic surface, so it has sort of an SL2R twiddle structure. So it, the universal cover fibers over the circle, which is the symmetric space for PSL2R, i.e. RP1, and, well, pi1M acts like it's bundle maps because the group is contained in SL2R twiddle. And you all know that such guys need not necessarily have non-trivial first Betti number. All right. Another example. This is, I guess, Lee Mosher described lots of examples of this form. Maybe you have, might contain some quasi-Fuchsian surface. Let's not worry about what that means. For example, it could be a totally geodesic surface. And maybe we have some flow line X, some flow X. Well, if every vector field, if every integral curve of X hits this quasi-Fuchsian surface pretty often, the lifts of this surface to the universal cover kind of give you a bunch of, distance markers. So you could argue that X would have to be quasi-geodesic. Well, you could do that, of course, if M fibers over a circle. Otherwise, it's not so easy. But suppose that every flow line of X either hits this surface every so often, or spends a lot of time near some closed geodesic gamma, well then, when it's hitting sigma often, that's a good way of measuring distance. When it spends a lot of time near gamma, that's another good way of measuring distance. So you can convince yourself there's lots of examples of quasi-geodesic flows of this kind. And in fact, Gabay Moshe and Fenley Moshe show, in fact, that whenever M has positive first Betti number, there's lots of examples of this kind. So quasi-geodesic flows are pretty common on hyperbolic 3 manifolds. And Thurston actually asked the question at one point of whether every hyperbolic 3 manifold has a quasi-geodesic flow. Well, so it's one of the corollaries of what I'm going to talk about today that in fact, isn't the case. So by developing a little bit more structure associated to a quasi-geodesic flow, we can find some criteria for its existence, which can fail to be satisfied in some examples, for instance. All right. So how does the topology of the leaf space and the geometry of the universal cover of M interact? So one has the universal cover of M, which is H3, which we can think of as the unit ball in the Poincaré model, compactified by the sphere at infinity. And every quasi-geodesic is within a bounded distance of an actual geodesic, and you can estimate how far you have to move it in terms of this constant k of quasi-geodesity. Now, the fact that these flow lines are uniformly k quasi-geodesic implies, in fact, that the map which takes each flow line to its pair of endpoints in the sphere at infinity is continuous. So there are two continuous maps from this leaf space to the sphere at infinity. Well, they're continuous and they're equivariant with respect to the action of pi 1 of m. Pi 1 m acts here by the holonomy representation, it acts here by the action at infinity of a discrete group of isometries of hyperbolic space. And, well, in particular, since m is closed, the only non-empty closed invariant subsets of the sphere at infinity are, well, the whole sphere. So that implies that the image of both px under e plus and under e minus are both dense. All right. Well, okay, so that has the following corollary. So, let me state this as a lemma. Let's let D be a disk in the leaf space, then E plus of the disk and E plus of the boundary are equal. Well, E plus of the boundary certainly has to be contained in E plus of the disk. We just have to show the other direction. Well, how could this fail to be true? If not, we have, so here's maybe some global cross-section for our flow, and here's our disk D. If not, we have some collection of flow lines which are flowing out from the boundary of the disk, and they're hitting some closed subset of the sphere up here, but they're separated from the image of some point in the interior, which is flowing away to some point in here. In particular, there's some little open half space in H3 which is shielded from the rest of, from everything outside by this green cylinder. Well, on the other hand, E minus of Px is dense in S2 infinity, so there's some flow line which in negative time, maybe it starts over here, somehow has to get back and crash through this cylinder and make its way arbitrarily close to the endpoint of this orange arrow. And, well, that's a contradiction. Well, so the corollary then is that the image of the boundary of the disk is equal to the image of the disk. Well, that's a kind of a funny way of saying what I really want to say, which is that point preimages, the connected components of point preimages are unbounded. So I'm going to define some equivalence relations on this leaf space, which is a plane, which are exactly the equivalence classes are these connected components. Okay, so here's the plane. Somehow you have to put it in a box to draw it. And you have some point preimage, which, well, maybe I shouldn't be so kind of whatever. Maybe there's some, you know, topologist sine curve in there going off to infinity. It's only connected components, not path-connected components. But anyway, the point preimages are unbounded. So here's some K. It's a equivalence class. Of say twiddle plus. All right, so I'm going to define some auxiliary structure now from the global topology of this equivalence relation. So I'm going to define for each equivalence class K a set E sub K, which is the set of M's of K. And I'm going to define capital E plus through the union over all K, which are equivalence classes. This is bad notation, but equivalence classes of this equivalence relation of these n's. Now, the key property of this set is that, well, there are two key properties. The first is that because it's completely natural, it comes with an action of pi 1 of m on it. And secondly, it has a natural circular order defined on it. I mean, what do I mean by a circular order? I just mean for every triple of distinct points in the set, it gets a label clockwise or anticlockwise, and this should be a cocycle, meaning that it's compatible on quadruples of points. And it has an action of pi 1 of m on it. And where does this circular order come from? Well, I have to tell you, if I have three n's of equivalence classes, whether they're anticlockwise or clockwise ordered, I'm going to use the topology of the plane to define that ordering. Well, the fact that these n's are, that these equivalence classes are merely connected and not path connected means that I don't want to define my n's using, say, rays contained in the set, but I can use the following kind of little trick. I can just look at rays which outside compact subsets eventually stay within any open neighborhood of the end. So a ray which kind of goes off to infinity, morally speaking, closer and closer to one of the ends, is going to be a geometric gadget which stands in for this end. So if I have three such geometric gadgets, well, here's the plane again. So I have three such geometric gadgets. Maybe they intersect, but any two of them intersect only in a compact subset, or else they would have to exit the same end of the same equivalence class. And that means they get a natural circular order by, well, find a big disk which contains all the intersections of them in pairs and look at the three points where these rays last exit the set, then they get a circular order. And one can check that's compatible on quadruples. In fact, for any finite set of rays, you just do find a big enough disk to contain all the pairwise intersections of them. So this gets a natural circular order, and there's some standard topology you can do at this point. Take the order completion, put it in a circle and blow down the gaps, and obtain on the nose a circle together with a natural action of pi 1 of m on it. Okay. And one can argue that the point stabilizers are trivial or cyclic. Morally, they just come from, if you stabilize a point, say it was actually came from some E plus, then there was actually some equivalence class K which was preserved. In particular, the image under these endpoint map, the image under the endpoint map was preserved. So that's a particular point in the sphere of infinity, and the stabilizer of a point at infinity is either trivial or cyclic for a closed Hilbert 3 manifold. So one can soup this up into an argument that the action is faithful. Well, so one immediately gets as a corollary non-existence if you have a 3-manifold whose fundamental group has no faithful homomorphism to homeo plus S1, well, the manifold has no quasi-geodesic flow. So an example is if you look at 5152 surgery on the Whitehead link, this is a manifold called the Weeks manifold. It's the smallest known closed hyperbolic 3 manifold. Pi 1 of this has no faithful homomorphism into homeo plus S1. And therefore, this guy has no quasi-geodesic flow. Okay, well, so that's one of the topological gadgets you can get out of this flow, this circle at infinity. That's kind of interesting because we have a flow in a 3-manifold, and we've reduced the study of that flow to the study of the fundamental group on a 1-dimensional manifold. So there's been a very interesting sort of dimensional reduction. From codimension 2, we've got now a sort of 1-dimensional gadget in which we can study the dynamics. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is laminations. Tie in with one of the themes of this conference. So I want to talk about laminations of a circle. So a lamination of a circle is just a closed subset of the space of pairs, unordered pairs, of distinct points in S1 such that no two link. I mean, two S0s in S1 can link or not. So make the convention that if two S0s share an endpoint in common, they're not linked. So that's allowed. So an example is the endpoint data of a typical geodesic lamination on H2. Here's H2. Here's a bunch of geodesics. The pairs of endpoints you get, they're obviously unlinked because the geodesics don't cross. It's a closed set of geodesics, so you get a closed set of pairs of points. All right, so we have these equivalence classes K. One way we'd like to define some laminations is to say, well, if I have a particular class K, I can just look at the union of all the ends E sub K. I can think of that as a collection of points in my circle at infinity, in my universal circle. I can look at the set of complementary open intervals to the closure of that set and take the pairs of endpoints of that. Well, that's somehow a lamination associated to the set K. We'd like to know two things. First of all, we'd like to know that for different K, these laminations don't intersect, so that the closure of their union is a lamination. That's kind of clear because the sets don't intersect. And second of all, most importantly, we want to know that these sets are not empty. So if K has a single end, a single point in the circle, complementary interval has only a single endpoint, so to speak. So you get no leaf from that. So the property we want to prove is that some of our equivalence classes are separating. Okay. Well, how could this fail to be the case? Well, if every equivalence class had a single end, remember, every equivalence class is non-compact, it has at least one end. So if not, every equivalence class has a unique end, which we can just write, of course, by, well, E sub K, it's just a point, of course. So we have our plane, P sub X, and we have our circle, and then the union of a plane and a circle is a disk, and every equivalence class K has some unique end. So this map K to EK defines a retraction from the closed disk to its boundary, which we know can't happen. So there's a contradiction, and therefore some equivalence class is separating. Well, so now it's easy to construct laminations. We have our plane, we have maybe some equivalence class K, another separating equivalence class over here, L, another one over here, M. well, in our universal circle, K gives us 3 points in this sort of example. L gives us 2 points. M gives us here 4 points. And, well, we can just sort of do a convex hull construction and take the boundary of the convex hull of the set spanned by the closure of these points, if you think of S1 as bounding a copy of H2. And the fact that K and M and L are all disjoint implies, of course, that these leaves can't link. I mean, if one pair of ends of M linked a pair of ends of K, well, M and K would have to intersect, which they don't because they're disjoint. All right. And connected, I guess I should stress. All right, so one obtains laminations. Which are non-empty, of course, of these pairs of circles, which are preserved by the action of pi 1 of m. So one gets a different action of m on a one-dimensional gadget, namely the dual R trees to these laminations. Okay, so there are trees, quote-unquote, which are dual to these laminations. The points in the tree basically correspond either to leaves of the lamination or complementary regions. And pi 1 of m acts on these trees without global fixed points. One uses here now a result of Friendly. There exist infinitely many hyperbolic three manifolds without let me just say, such that every action of pi 1 of m on a topological R tree has a global fixed point. Let me not call them R trees. Let me call them order trees. Think of the underlying topological space of an R tree without the metric. So the group acts by homeomorphisms of that R tree, not by isometries of it. So you can call it an order tree instead of an R tree. Anyway, so there are, therefore, infinitely many hyperbolic three manifolds without quasi-geodesic flows. Well, that's kind of interesting so far as it goes. I'd like to say now another kind of more positive property of quasi-geodesic flows, which is that one can use the structure theory to characterize a set of quasi-geodesic flows on a manifold, at least in the case in which H1 is positive. Okay. So recall the definition of the Thurston norm. On the homology of a three-manifold, and we want M to be irreducible, i.e. having no essential spheres, and probably a toroidal as well, having no essential tori. So every sphere bounds a ball, every torus bounds a solid torus or is a wormhole in a solid ball. So in this case, well, there's this nice norm defined by Thurston, which defined in the following way: on an integral homology class, look at all the surfaces that represent that which have no spherical components, look at the negative of the Euler characteristic, and that's the, take the infimum over that set of surfaces, that's the value of the norm in that homology class. Then it turns out, well, you can extend it by linearity to rational homology classes, and then by continuity to real homology classes. And the key property is, well, a key property is that the unit ball is a finite-sided polyhedron. Okay. So, well, the dual norm is also a finite-sided polyhedron. And then there's a key property due to Gabay, which is that surfaces which are norm-minimizing leaves of finite depth taut foliations. You don't really need to worry about what taut means. I mean, maybe from the terminology, you get the idea it has something to do with being able to realize the foliation with a metric such that all the leaves are minimal surfaces. In any case, the main use we want to make of this is a construction due to Gabay Moshe, which says that for each such more minimizing sigma, there exists a pseudo Anosov flow X such that the Euler class of the flow evaluated on this surface is the norm of the homology class. Okay. Well, what's the Euler class of a flow? I mean, a flow on a three-manifold is dual to some two-dimensional distribution well-defined up to homotopy, and it's just the abstraction to trivializing that two-dimensional bundle. So it's a two-dimensional cohomology class, integral cohomology class. You can evaluate it on a two-dimensional surface and get an integer. So the claim is that every norm-minimizing surface actually can be detected by some pseudo-Anosov flow. Okay. Of course, one needs to have the norm be, the H2 be non-trivial in order for such a flow to exist. And then one has a further result of Finley Moshe, which says that these flows can be taken to be quasi-geodesic. So I just want to point out a kind of converse of this, which is that if we have a quasi-geodesic flow in a hyperbolic three-manifold, well, we get an action of pi 1 of m on a circle, and there's another Euler class one gets from an action on a circle. So let me just sort of write this way. So quasi-geodesic flow gives rise to an action of pi 1 of m on, well, one of two universal circles. So one gets from this an Euler class . So, I mean, how should one describe such an Euler class? Well, a two-dimensional cohomology class, integral cohomology class, is the same thing as a central extension by Z. So one has pi 1 of m mapping to a group of homeomorphisms of a circle. Then there's a nice central extension of the group of homeomorphisms of a circle, which is just the group of homeomorphisms of R, which are periodic with some fixed period, say 2 pi, and one just looks at the corresponding central extension of pi 1 of m. A central extension corresponds to a two-dimensional cohomology class. That's the Euler class in question. So the Euler class turns out, of course, to be the same as the Euler class associated to this flow. But knowing that it's being factored through an action of pi 1 of m on a circle gives us the following inequality due to Milnor and Wood, which says that if E, we just say, arises from a, let me say it in the following way. Supposing we have a homomorphism from pi 1 of some surface to homeomorphism of a circle with corresponding Euler class E sub rho, then E sub rho applied to sigma in absolute value is less than or equal to minus Euler characteristic of sigma. Here we want Euler characteristic of sigma to be non-positive. Otherwise, one would have to take, of course, pi 1 of a sphere is not very interesting, but one has to modify the statement anyway. So the Milner-Wood inequality says whenever the fundamental group of a surface acts on a circle, the Euler class in absolute value is no bigger than minus the Euler characteristic. In particular, for every surface in our three manifold representing a homology class, pi 1 of it acts on this universal circle, so the Euler class evaluated on that surface is less than or equal to the Thurston norm of that homology class. Conversely, we can see that all the extremal homology classes can actually be realized. So as a corollary, the unit ball in the dual Thurston norm is the convex hull of the Euler classes of quasi-geodesic flows. I'll say that again. The unit ball of, let me write it like this. This is just the dual norm on cohomology. Is the convex hull of the set of Euler classes of X, where X ranges over all the quasi-geodesic flows. M. Okay. So, anyway, so this is kind of a finiteness theorem, at least at the homological level. Still leaves open the question of whether there are only finitely many homotopy classes of flows which are can be realized by quasi-geodesic flows in a hyperbolic three-manifold. Oh, I guess I should say the hypotheses here are that M is hyperbolic, and that H2M is non-zero. Well, so this makes sense. All right. I think that's sort of all I wanted to say.